You're back with another episode of The Geek Whispers. This is Matt Brender.
And I'm Amy Lewis.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
And we are excited, as always, to bring to you another great topic with inside this interesting community meets technology world that we live in. We are joined today by a special guest from the origin of much of the influence marketing that we do today, from Microsoft. Simon, we're so happy to have you. Could you introduce yourself?
Great. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on here. It was great to meet a few of you when I've been traveling, actually on the road and presenting. So I'm really happy that I can join you on this webcast today. Now, I'm Simon Perriman. I am currently a senior technical evangelist with Microsoft. And believe it or not, that's a real job. A lot of people don't think that's a real title. And, you know, when I travel down the South, I get a different view of what an evangelist means. But I'm basically a corporate promoter. I came from a technical background. I've been at Microsoft about 7 years, spending about half of my time on the engineering team, building distributed systems, high availability, virtual machines, and some data center management technologies. And then about 3-4 years ago, I realized that I'm one of the few engineers that has that ability to actually be a good communicator as well. So I really wanted to try to leverage that skill and move on to really more of a customer-facing role as an evangelist. And so we kind of have a unique position at Microsoft. There's only 4 of us at corporate that basically cover worldwide responsibility for our IT professional technologies. So that's Windows Server, System Center, Microsoft Azure, and then like our enterprise client technologies. So, you know, how do you deploy and manage thousands of, Windows 8 machines at once? So as part of that role, I get to be involved kind of across the board, across lots of different Microsoft projects. And a lot of them are the customer-facing programs that you guys may have heard of, may have recognized, like the Microsoft MVPs, some of our social media activities, learning partners, user groups. So trying to, you know, really see how we can influence customers across the board through multiple different channels.
Ooh, Matt, yeah. Matt, I got one. Matt, can
go
I jump
for
in?
It, John.
So, Simon, you are not prepped ahead of time. We have not spoken
to you.
That's
correct. I think you're going to put me on the spot right now.
We gave you no notes. We did not. No. You played perfectly into our hands. What you didn't know is on this show for the last year, we've been talking about these people who are engineers who make the shift into kind of more as communicators. Amy's term for them are unicorns.
Unicorns, magic, huh?
Well, you're kind of mythical. You're kind of hard to find. Amy, that's the kind of the origin of it, right?
It's the rare combination of technologists, as you said, who can articulate. You just defined a unicorn.
So what I'm really interested in, before we get into like the sausage making of what we do in our daily, you know, jobs, I'm actually fascinated, Simon, how when you made that shift, and actually Matt was another person. He was an engineer, made the shift over into marketing, went into sales, back into marketing. He's a little fickle. But in your case, was it a big shift for you when you made the jump from engineering into a more evangelist role? Did it feel like a real org chart shift? Did it feel like a cultural shift? Did you feel like you're irrevocably closing off some of your career choices? Or can you go into maybe some of that?
Yes. Uh-huh. It definitely, like when you kind of go become an engineer, right, whether you're a computer scientist and you're writing code or you've done, you know, electrical engineering or college, things like that, you know, you kind of think of yourself as having like kind of a fixed career path of just really aiming on that technical stuff. And so trying to make that move to definitely more of a marketing role was tough. And, you know, thinking about the career path was probably one of the hardest decisions to do that. You know, once you move out of engineering, could I lose some of my technical competency? Maybe. Do I lose, you know, connections within the engineering organization? Maybe. I mean, so doing that, there is certainly a lot of inherent risk. You know, you're taking yourself out of your comfort zone. But one thing that really made me, I guess, feel a little less challenged with the change was in my role as an engineer, as a program manager on that team, I was already doing a lot of customer-facing events and activities, and I was doing a good job of them. So that kind of gave me a little bit of confidence that I would be able to succeed in the role. But more importantly, I really liked that side of the role. And I think, you know, to be not just good, but to be really good at a particular job, you have to be passionate about it. And I felt that, you know, I was passionate about meeting with the customers, giving presentations, running our community program back when I was still an engineer. So there's definitely some risk, but at the same time, you know, if you're passionate about something and you believe you can do a good job, that type of risk-reward trade-off, I think, can be worth it. So I would definitely encourage people out there that are in these kind of core, you know, STEM courses, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. If you have that ability to still be a good communicator, that can really open up other avenues for you. Because when you kind of flip and look at the other side of it as a marketing person, one of the reasons why I'm a great marketing resource to my own company is because I do have that technical depth as well. So that makes me an extremely successful marketer because I can, you know, I know why we're doing these things, the impact that it makes to our customers. And then when I actually get put in front of a customer, oftentimes, you know, your standard marketing person might get a technical question. They'll get squeamish on stage, you know, look flustered and kind of look incompetent. But since I can actually really connect with those engineering people, that gives me, you know, a lot more credibility as well that I can, you know, kind of play both sides of the fence there.
Amen. Sure, sure. Yeah, you definitely have some street credibility by being on an engineering team for a big part of your career. And yeah, I fluctuated around that space too and really enjoyed it. I love that you immediately were just like, yes, good. it's opening doors. I definitely was more tentative around the doors that they were closing because marketing can be used as such a pejorative in our industry. But I really agree that if you work hard at understanding the technology, people will respect you for you. They don't care about your title quite as much. So it's great to have you. The idea of your evangelism role is very interesting, and we've dug into that with a few different past guests. But I think we're going to pivot. We're going to talk today about both the modern history of community at Microsoft and where we think it's going, and maybe get some Q&A on what that feels like being inside, you know, what appears to be a well-oiled, massive machine. In our tech industry that is just, you know, spreading out from Windows Server up to many cloudy services. So I think we'll just jump right in, guys. Microsoft, I mean, we've all alluded to it that each of the programs that we've created has been inspired by the MVP program. Simon, are you engaged in the MVP program right now, or how does that look like from inside, from where you stand as an evangelist?
Now, MVP program, just to maybe give a little more context to some of our listeners that may not know, that's the Microsoft Most Valuable Professional Program. And it's essentially an award that we give to community members that are influential, not employed by Microsoft, but really making tangible contributions to help grow our brand, help grow visibility, but most importantly, helping other people in the community learn from them. So things that we look for as an MVP are people that, in their free time, again, not being paid, not part of the job, but people that are just passionate about sharing their knowledge, whether that's through blogs, webcasts, community events, training videos, running user groups. So really people that are trying to be influential in their community, again, not because they're being paid to do so because it's their job, but because they really care about, you know, trying to improve knowledge, share that knowledge and help others. So with that as kind of the background as far as what is an MVP, the MVP program has been around for a while. It started off, you know, with a dozen members or so. It's now up to several thousand, spanning all of Microsoft's different technologies. Some of the largest groups are SQL Server. They have several hundred MVPs. Some of the smaller groups are actually Microsoft Surface. They only have a few MVPs. So the actual breadth of the MVP program does range based on which technology you're focused on. Now, the way to become an MVP, there's no just kind of guaranteed way. There's no prescriptive guidance where if you do these five things, you become it, because it's based on a nomination system. And so what happens is once a quarter, each team basically, let me take a step back actually. So within all of these different organizations at Microsoft, like SQL, Windows Server, System Center, Hyper-V, within each of these, you know, different technologies, there's what's called an MVP lead. And that's basically someone on the engineering team that is responsible for maintaining the community and the relationships with their respective MVPs. So back when I was on the cluster team, I was the MVP lead for that. And I had about, we ranged from about 10 to 15 MVPs at any point in time. And it was basically my responsibility to stay active in the community by looking at, you know, these dogs, user group forums, to newsletters, doing presentations, and basically identifying people that, you know, genuinely had passion about sharing their knowledge around my technology clustering. Now, what we would do is, once we really kind of identified someone that could be a good candidate, we'd actually start tracking them over several quarters. And the reason why we wanted to do that was to ensure that they were making consistent contributions. You know, it wasn't like their friend tipped them off and said, hey, you know, go write 10 blogs this month and you'll get this award. We really do look for it over the course of several years. So really, you know, kind of add that credibility that this is someone that's, you know, has been doing it for a while and wants to continue to do that. Because the MVP, it gets re-awarded every year. So it's not just a one-time thing. You get it, you keep it. Once you earn that achievement, it's something that you still need to maintain by staying active in the community and continuing to help others. And if you stop doing those, you know, contributions, stop helping out, you may actually be removed from the program the following review cycle. So it is something where we do encourage ongoing participation, you know, continuing to help, staying competent like that.
That leads me to a question. Great description. I think a lot of the different programs have similar elements. How would you compare an MVP to some of the other influencer programs? Because before we got on, started recording, you mentioned, and I don't know if you can rattle a few of those off for our listeners who are not familiar. MVP is probably the one a lot of us know. But it sounds like there's a lot of groundwork being laid in terms of influencer programs. What are some of the programs and how does somebody decide between which one they engage with?
Well, that's a great question. So I guess, first of all, it's important to know that people can't necessarily volunteer to be an MVP. You know, it is something that Microsoft designates, Microsoft awards someone. So you can't just sign up and suddenly be an MVP. Now, because it has such a high barrier of entry, and in many cases it is competitive, you know, some MVP programs, they only have a limited number of MVPs per cycle, and you have to be the top, you know, X number to continue to make that. That kind of varies because it does have that kind of competitive edge. And for that reason, you know, it is highly valued. And one thing that I really hear from a lot of MVPs that I've spoken to after they've got the award is kind of the doors that it opens up for them. By having that on the resume, it really adds a lot of credibility, both with their current employer, as well as for their career, for potential future employers. Because it's not really somebody coming out and saying, you know, trust me, I'm an expert. It's Microsoft telling other people, trust us, this guy's an expert. So I think that just difference between the award versus something you volunteer for is kind of a big difference there. Yeah, but some of the other – sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say it is interesting the differences between that and the vExpert program because, I mean, I created the vExpert program in a lot of ways modeled after the MVP program, but it's really interesting. The MVP program is really many programs. I don't think people realize that if they're not in the Microsoft universe. The vExpert program and some of the others that we run have that I know about are more singular programs, more centralized. So that's one interesting thing. And I love the fact that at Microsoft, the MVP lead is from engineering. Getting engineering support for some of these marketing programs can sometimes really be a challenge. I think that's a real super grounding factor in keeping MVPs definitely valid.
And I think, you know, they really appreciate that as well, because what that means for an MVP is they have direct access to an engineer for the technology that they're an expert in. And so that can give them, you know, and their customers other benefits, right? If they're working, you know, maybe at a customer site, they hit a particularly nasty bug and they need to do debugging down to the API level. And maybe that's, you know, there's no documentation. They just simply cannot find how to resolve the issue. They can just pick up the phone or email their buddy. Let's not kid. Nobody uses a phone anymore. They could just go and email their friend and just say, hey, engineering guy, I'm stuck on this particular problem. There's no documentation. The engineering guy can actually go work with the developers, figure it out, share the information back. And that actually benefits both parties because not only does that MVP and their customer have a solution, but it highlights to the engineering team, hey, we're missing some documentation, or we need to help other people understand this issue. Maybe that's a, you know, good indication that this could be a great blog post in the future. So there really is, you know, a lot of a two-way benefit from having and running these engineering programs. You know, we really do try to get as much value out of the MVPs as possible through getting their feedback, having them do early testing, taking a look at future features before they're released. So, you know, there are a lot of benefits that roll right back to the, you know, Microsoft community as well from having these trusted advisors, these trusted experts too.
That makes a lot of sense. And also, I love the bat phone approach to it. That's kind of like the way I'd sum up that strategy real quick, that basically the individual has a bat phone to get right to engineering, and that benefits everyone because then it becomes great fodder for a blog post that turns into case deflection for the company. It just has such positive downstream effects when you allow those relationships to be fostered. That said, it's really interesting how many other programs you were mentioning that Microsoft runs related to influencers and engagement with individuals. So can you remind us a little bit, Simon, of some of the other programs we were talking about before the show? And maybe we can start discussing the idiosyncrasies of how they overlap with MVP and how they play nicely and maybe compete at times.
Sure. Thanks for pulling me back on course here. So probably the next big, the next kind of big community group that we interact with would be our user groups. So a user group, I think one thing that's kind of different between the Microsoft user groups and let's say the VMware user group, VMUG, for example, mm-hmm. Is that Microsoft's user groups are not centralized. You know, you might have a user group based out of California that's specifically focused on IT pros. You might have a user group in Boston that does mobile deployment and management. And like, you know, they'll be completely separate organizations and names, completely unrelated to each other. And so Microsoft doesn't, you know, manage kind of this large singular entity. We basically allow these user groups to dynamically grow, help themselves, and then we still go and support and manage each of them individually, no matter where they're based, no matter what their name is, no matter what their technical focus is, so long as, you know, they are spending time promoting Microsoft technologies. So within these user groups, you know, essentially what we do is we work primarily with the user group lead. So the user group lead, they will go and enroll in one of our user group programs. And from that point on, once we, you know, basically know that this user group exists, we have them registered, we'll start supporting them by offering them resources such as technical content or speakers. We'll keep them informed about upcoming Microsoft events that their user group participants may be interested in, like webcasts, live hands-on labs, things like that. And ultimately, you know, we try to encourage and foster that user group community. Another big challenge, though, we hear from the user group community is always around funding, you know, even down to just having money to rent a venue for, you know, a couple hours. And so what we try to do is really try to be supportive of just that budgetary issue by actually letting the user groups use Microsoft offices. And if they're actually presenting content that, you know, we are specifically building for user groups, we'll even do things such as fund the food, drinks, bring a guest speaker in. So we really do try to support them, not just with the content, but also with the financial responsibilities that a lot of them have too.
Yeah, that's a big issue for even for the VMware user groups, right? They need sponsors. And so some sponsors, you know, work out well, and some think they've bought some sort of advertising platform and bore everybody to death. So it is a challenge, I think, if you're running an independent user group, just to get even just to get pizza money.
Yeah, nerds yep. Gotta eat. Amy, what does that make you think of? Do you find the distributed model of influence marketing at Microsoft to be attractive? Do you still kind of err on the side of hub and spoke, or do models fit appropriately for different orgs?
I am very interested, of course, in the org chart application here. And I would throw that to Simon of, you know, how has that worked over the years? Has everybody sort of bumped along happily, or is it a matter of some of the influence marketing programs kind of align with internal Microsoft organization charts so that people can kind of reach their buying centers individually or succeed in their marketing objectives or programmatic objectives?
And is all this coming from corporate or from field geographic regions?
Yeah, and has it changed? Have there been lessons learned where, you know, maybe people have gone at it one way and maybe they've grouped three groups into one, or maybe they've split one group into three?
You know, it really has varied significantly. I don't think there's just a single answer. what we really find is that, you know, since there's several thousand user groups worldwide that, you know, we work with, be just trying to consolidate that into a single uniform organization, I think we've just decided against, you know, I think we want to keep them organic, keep them self-sufficient, not necessarily have the responsibility to maintain them if, you know, they don't have good leadership, they become unsuccessful. And so I guess, you know, comparing it to like the VMware user group, VMUG, I see a lot of benefits from that centralized model, right? You kind of have a consistent membership, consistent communication through the regular newsletters. I am a member, by the way. I am a VMware certified professional as well, so I am part of that user group. I certainly see that synergy, that consistency across all those different resources does add a lot of value. You know, you can go to a single location. You have your local user group leads, regional, nationwide. And, you know, it's run by VMUG's now run by a professional organization as well. So having that structure has a lot of benefits. What I hear negative about the VMware user group, though, and one of the things that Microsoft tries to avoid there is sometimes it can be too dictatorial about what you should be doing. You know, you should now be focusing only on hybrid cloud. You have to pay this much in fees. You know, you have to pay our central user group money to maintain your email system, things like that. And so I find that there is sometimes resistance to these local user groups saying, hey, I want to be technology agnostic. You know, VMware is great, but I also want to learn about Hyper-V or Citrix virtualization as well. And so we actually saw about 2 or 3 years ago, several of the VMware user groups actually wanted to become platform agnostic. And so they actually split off from VMUG entirely and formed what they called VTUG, the Virtualization Technology User Group. And VTUG is now in, it's in Boston, it is in San Jose, Chicago, Indianapolis, and a few other locations where they had a lot of VMware followers, but they wanted to just learn about other platforms, you know, and part of that isn't really a competitive thing. A lot of that is for their own benefit. You know, if I'm a virtualization admin and I'm only proficient in one technology, yet I know that, hey, if I now go and learn Hyper-V or I go learn Citrix Xen, I can double my salary because I'm that much more valuable to the company. A lot of people like that flexibility, you know, being able to learn about these new technologies and avoiding the vendor lock-in. Yeah. So I think, you know, that is one benefit of the Microsoft model, that we don't force user groups that, you know, we work with only to use our technology or only to use our content or only to use our Microsoft stuff. So they have that flexibility, which I guess a lot of the people appreciate, you know, that we're not really, I guess, forcing them to fit to a specific mold. Yet we're still trying to support them when we can.
Well, Simon, in terms of org chart, where do you fit in the Microsoft org chart? Are you part of kind of a central marketing organization or how does that work?
We are in our own organization known as Evangelism. We're actually known as Developer Experience, recently got rebranded. And even though I'm not a developer, a lot of the focus for Microsoft's forward-thinking activities is around applications and services. So most of my organization is actually focused on building apps, whether that's for Azure, Windows 8, Windows Phone. So there's only a few of us that are really focused on the IT pro kind of infrastructure technologies. And so within our org, we're basically broken up into several teams. We have an events team that runs things such as conferences. We have our learning team, which essentially runs Microsoft certifications, so all of those programs. We have our pure marketing team, which is focused on, you know, the websites, tracking users, programs such as TechNet, kind of those various customer-facing programs. And then we have the technical organization, which is what I fit under. And we're basically used as, I don't know, kind of like wildcards, you know. Hey, we need somebody that has both marketing skills and technical skills. Go help. So whether that's, you know, the marketing team is coming out with the latest release and they want to understand how to best connect that to the users of the technology, I go help marketing. Or when engineering has a brand new feature that they want to release and they want to help gain visibility for that, they'll come to me. They'll help me understand the technology. And then I can go and start to include that in content that I create, in presentations that I'm delivering, so that I can help, you know, promote that from the technical side. being a kind of in the technical org, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of challenges and it's a lot of randomization. but it's something that I'm not the type of guy that likes to just sit in the office and do the same thing 5 days a week. You know, I like to get out there. I like to have variety and diversity. And so I found this job, it definitely does that. You know, it challenges you. I have to be proficient in about 50 or 60 Microsoft technologies now. And I'll literally, you know, go to a customer. They'll say, hey, tomorrow they want to go learn about, you know, Microsoft Site Recovery, a brand new feature that was announced last week. And I got a couple hours to go figure out how to build it, how to demo it, how it works, and how it integrates into their system.
It's interesting, Simon, that it's nice to have a separate org like that. The more traditional kind of software way that I'm used to anyways, you know, you have technical marketing people that are often associated with at least at VMware, they're associated with the product marketers, and the technical marketers are another group. Community team can sometimes come out of support, or in my case, I was in corporate marketing, but work closely with the business units. But, you know, we were kind of in marketing, even though we had some technical people. But I think it's really fascinating that Microsoft is big enough and has orged itself so that you actually have this whole separate organization that's kind of community evangelism, marketing, events, that's separate from separate from the people who are buying, you know, the magazine ads and things like that, the demand gen marketing people.
That's fair. You know, we still have those orgs. We still have our technical product managers, and they tend to more own the business relationships with engineering and with people that are building software to go and connect with that, you know, ISV partners, hardware partners. So as you said, you know, it is odd that we do have our own organization. And I guess, you know, sometimes that is the benefit of being such a large company.
Oh, I don't think it's odd. I think it's great. I think
you have that flexibility, and you can be, you know, in kind of this unique wild card position. And I know a lot of the major tech companies out there, they do have this technical evangelist role. You know, Amazon has it for their web services. VMware has it as well. So, you know, certainly not unique, but for a smaller company, I could see that being kind of a challenging position to really find and be able to, you know, purely focus on this kind of channel.
Sure. Yeah. As somebody who's been living in a startup for a little bit here, it's interesting to see the idea of evangelism as something that is a function of how far you are in a certain process of your sales cycle and community building. I'm interested,
size.
Simon.
Size
is a huge factor.
I think it's interesting, and you know, maybe a podcast for another day, but an interesting question to approach, and we'd love to hear our listeners and see what they think. At what size is an organization that they need, require, benefit from somebody with evangelist in their title?
That's where I would disagree with you, and maybe we should save it for that other episode. But I don't think it's a function of size. I think it's a function of process and sales cycle. So we should get somebody on another time and continue to argue, Amy. But I don't want to limit our time with Simon to our internal banter that we need to have.
So Simon, as we sort of continue down this org chart path and how things are broken out, how much crossover, like you said, it sounds like you're sort of an independent, it almost sounds like a little bit of a gun for hire, and that you have to become competent in a lot of different technologies to sort of cross over. What about as you do outreach? And that certainly speaks to, you know, Microsoft, a strategy of making sure they have a lot of internal resources that are available. What about in terms of that external outreach? How do those programs work in terms of folks who have roles like yourself, then working with the external influencers, so third-party folks?
That's a really good question. I think it varies significantly based on the individual. You know, as I look at other people that are in a similar role to myself, you know, a lot of it is what you're passionate about. Now, I've been spending a lot of time working with some of our software and hardware partners, helping them actually build solutions that will run on the Microsoft platform. I have a background in economics, so I've always kind of been interested in the business side of this as well. And so being able to foster business relationships, going to a VMware conference and speaking to vendors and saying, hey, are you guys interested in building this on the Microsoft stack? Kind of fostering that relationship, giving them a demo, walking them through the technical basics of how to do it. And then several months later, seeing them release a Microsoft version of the technology. For me, that's personally rewarding, but it's something that I'm proactively going out and finding. We don't necessarily have fixed metrics that you have to, you know, manage 10 business relationships or things like that. Now, speaking purely on the, on the presentation side, which a lot of people see us doing, you know, things like webcasts, going to conferences, you know, reaching out to those individual customers one-to-one. That's definitely a key part of the evangelist role. You know, as an evangelist, really breadth evangelism is kind of one of our key focuses, the one-to-many type of relationship.
Question there, would that be something like a blogger briefing? Again, would you work with the MVPs? How would that look programmatically?
Programmatically, there's really no structure. I mean, it just varies based on, you know, the different roles. And so much of it is just relationship building. You know, I work with the MVPs because I work closely with the MVP leads through engineering contacts. When I do conferences, you know, I'm generally considered a pretty good conference speaker. And so what I'm able to do is I proactively find these conferences. I figure out how to get myself on the submission list so I can go and submit sessions. I have a nice, what I call a conference resume. That's just basically a detailed list of the, you know, all the conferences I speak at, the various presentation awards I've won. And just having that nice little package, it enables me to go and apply for, you know, dozens of conferences each year.
You're a guerrilla marketer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you kind of have to be that as an evangelist.
Are you also asked to make Heroes of the Brave? Are you also asked to then bring people on to panels with you? Because then it's not just a Microsoft voice, but an external voice.
Yeah, we do that as well. You know, I think the MVP program is a good example of that too. You know, with the MVP program, one thing that's really nice about that is that the community also trusts them. You know, the MVPs are considered the peers of, you know, our IT professionals. And oftentimes, you know, at Microsoft, we're perceived as, you know, being up in our ivory tower, right? You know, everyone sits in Redmond in their isolated cubicles with their stack of Red Bull in the corner, and they don't go out and speak to customers. And so what we really try to do with, you know, working with these MVPs, these community influencers, is trying to get them to co-present with us, get them to share the feedback, because, you know, if they're talking to their own customers, their own peers about a case study, oftentimes that's way more impactful than hearing the same type of information from a marketing person that, you know, hasn't really, you know, been in the trenches with them, hasn't really, you know, got those pages going off at 4 a.m. and had to drive to the data center. So I definitely think the leveraging peers of your customers is a very, very valuable resource, you know, really adding more credibility, that real world experience, and that trust factor as well. You know, our goal, you know, it's to sell our products, it's to make money. And so when I come there as a marketing guy saying we have the best solution in the world, people kind of have to take that with a grain of salt. But if I have an MVP that, you know, everybody knows and inspires them and is respected in the community saying, hey, this saved my customer $1.5 million in a 3-month cycle, that adds a lot more impact, a lot more credibility. And generally, that type of thing does resonate better with our customers too.
Very cool. That makes a lot of sense. Well, I got to ask the proverbial question from my angle, which is if you're allowed to do these sort of guerrilla tactics to get engaged in different events, and you have a rather structureless approach to engagement when it comes to cross collaboration, do you have any core measurements by which you're expected to deliver results to the business?
We do. We do and we don't. It is kind of loosely defined. Now, historically, as an evangelist, our whole, you know, looking back 2 or 3 years ago, our whole focus was just breadth evangelism. And so the metrics that we were evaluated on, you know, when we were looking at our annual review, it was purely numbers. It's, you know, how many customers did you do in-person presentations to, digital presentations to, how many people read your blog? And the problem with that was, it drove adverse behavior. You know, instead of writing one genuinely good blog, people would write, you know, a 20-part blog that was one paragraph each. So they would just get 20 times as many clicks. And so that model, you know, it really broke down when you were trying to compare people head to head. Because in many cases, you know, there were unfair comparisons. The evangelist based out of New York comparing him to the evangelist based in Kansas, it was unfair simply, you know, purely because of market size, things like that. So we broke down, we kind of got rid of that model at Microsoft about 2 or 3 years ago, and we really said, you know what, don't just focus on the numbers. That's still important. As an evangelist, you still need to, you know, meet certain goals that you set at the beginning of the year. But it's more about not just quantity, but quality. So that was kind of the second phase. And so we really started to build in evaluations with everything that we did. So it wasn't just, you know, how many people attended your webcast. It was how well did you get ranked in that webcast? You know, we have our internal
peer review.
Hence that peer review and actually customer feedback as well. And so one thing that I think surprises a lot of customers is just how competitive Microsoft speaking conferences are. You know, you have, let's say you go to a big Microsoft conference like TechEd. There's maybe 200-300 speakers. People think, cool, they just do their thing, then they go home. Well, behind the scenes, we have a speaker room which has all these big TVs in it. The TVs show the top 10 of, you know, based on the day, based on the speaker effectiveness, based on the quality of the presentation, based on the satisfaction of the customers. And people are, you know, constantly monitoring these, saying, you know, how did I rank? How many numbers did I get? So that kind of quality metric, that's added a lot of value too. But what we've really then tried to go with one step further, you know, beyond just the quantity, beyond being able to measure the quality, is now business impact. And that's been kind of a big focus for the past year within our organization. You know, everyone that's an evangelist, you know, we all know how to use Twitter and, you know, Facebook, and we can, you know, reach 10,000 people or 100,000 people in a year, no problem. But what does that reach and do? You know, how does that help the company? And so this big focus now, as far as providing business impact, is kind of harder to measure, but it's really kind of more shifting the conversation from a one-to-many relationship to oftentimes more of a one-to-one, where you are working with a specific customer or with a specific company to help them build a new product. And so, again, you know, it's really tough to measure that, right? You know, if I help one company build an add-on for Hyper-V, my peer helps a different company build an add-on for Windows 8 phone. Who's better, right? You know, and so kind of doing that head-to-head becomes a little more complex just because you're comparing apples to oranges. But that's now really been the biggest investment. Not just how many people are you reaching, how well are you delivering that message, but also what are the business results that you're seeing as a, you know, as a consequence of that? Have you convinced, you know, a company with 100,000 seats to do a migration from VMware over to Hyper-V, something like that? That would be a huge business impact. And so, again, sure, tough to quantify, but I think it's really more valuable because it's driving the right practice by our evangelists now. It's telling them, hey, don't just compete for these arbitrary numbers. Do what's right for the company. Do what's right for the business. Help us drive adoption of our platform and our technologies.
Yeah, it's powerful, even though it's anecdotal, right? Like, we're talking about one-off cases that have significant impacts. They're anecdotes, by definition. But that's not, that doesn't really holistically...
Case studies, Matt, in business, they're case studies.
I'm talking from a measurement point of view. They're individual cases, right? So they're...
Well, Matt,
yes?
When do you not talk from a measurement point of view? Just saying.
The day you don't support bacon consumption, which I hope to be never. So from that angle, I think it's incredibly powerful. There are opinions that, like, if you need to base your measurement purely off case studies, if we're going to use the term, John, then there might be something underlying that could be measured down the line. But I really appreciate that your team transferred from, you know, counting peanuts of number of views, number of blog posts, and just kind of seeing who gathered the most peanuts in front of them, and going to something of real business value and letting that translate and speak to the stories that matter to the business. It's very powerful.
I'd agree, really, and also kind of hard.
Wait, zoom in on that, John. What do you mean?
Yeah, no, I agree. Also kind of hard. I think people don't realize. I think they think we sit around, I don't know, smoking cigarettes and, you know, playing tiddlywinks or something. When I just could tell from the way Simon described that is they've really had deep – and Simon, I'm going to put words in your mouth. I'm going to divine your thoughts. I mean, I can tell they've really put a lot of thought into this. They've really kind of struggled with, okay, how do we measure our organization? How should we report back up to the rest of the business what we're doing? How do we justify more headcount? How are we really moving the needle for the business? And that's not a simple number, right? That's a multifactorial effect. Some of it can be measured, some of it can't. Some of it has effects way downstream. Are people excited about Microsoft? Or do people feel emotionally connected to it? Or, you know, and, you know, did we get new installations? Did partners, you know, do more business and all that sort of stuff? So it's, you know, Matt, I'm not a measurer, but I think it's
both. But you believe in it at the same time, because people, if you don't measure it, and here's a little secret about why I care about this stuff. If you don't measure it and it is successful, at some point the measurement is going to be looked at more than the success. So at some point down the line, you need to have some sort of quantification system to show improvement, or the funding will get cut. I've firmly seen that, and that's why I'm really curious, because it sounds like Simon and team are really struggling through some interesting stuff and have made more headway than I've heard in other places.
Let me take it back maybe to the personal for a second, Simon. We have talked with a lot of people in kind of evangelist roles. In many cases, when people get the evangelist, what do you get when you become an evangelist? A horn, a pair of wings, a crown? I'm not sure. But when you get anointed, go be an evangelist. It's to introduce a new technology, or it's to a new concept, or to you're changing people's minds. You're introducing them to new ideas. In some cases, we had one case where we were talking a few weeks ago. Somebody was saying it was often about acquisition. Like there was an acquisition, and then you're the evangelist, and you go out and tell everybody about this new thing in the new broader context. So now you, Simon, with Azure, you're preaching cloud to people, and private mm-hmm. cloud and hybrid cloud to people. For your career, is this a position that you're going to be in for 10 years? Or are you trying to figure out where the next technology or stepping stone or role for you? And also, can you be on, I mean, or, you know, it's also something that you have to be on the road for a lot too. So how are you looking at it from a career perspective, and what you do next?
That's a great question. You know, I've been in this role for about 3 to 4 years now. I've been successful in it, and it's something that I genuinely love to do. So I think one of the challenges that anyone struggles with is a job that they love doing versus, you know, a job that's going to be a great career move and can make them more money. You know, I know that if I switch to a different role or position, or switch to a different company even, you know, I could make more money in that. But at the same time, you really got to kind of compare that to the work-life balance and what you're personally passionate about. And so for me, I enjoy speaking to people. I'm a communicator. I'm an extrovert. So I do love the current role. And another big thing that I love is the travel from that as well. You know, I am on the road 1 to 2 weeks every month, you know, sometimes 3 weeks a month. I do a lot of conferences, but traveling is something I'm passionate about. So the fact that I can find a job that allows me to, you know, grow and nurture my passion. It allows me to see the world. And best of all, Bill Gates is paying for everything. You know, that makes it, you know, great. And so right now, I don't really have any immediate plans to, you know, leave this position or change. But a lot of it is, you know, making sure that you stay proficient and don't get fat, dumb, and happy by doing the same thing.
I guess that was one of my points, is that in 5 or 10 years, everyone will have gotten to that, whatever that next stage is, this hybrid cloud, you know, nirvana we're headed towards. So then you're going to have to be on to the next thing then.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, even though I want to stay in this evangelism role, I am constantly changing the technologies that I cover. You know, I got hired to purely do Windows Server and virtualization, but that was right around the time that the whole private cloud was really taking off. And there was no one that, you know, was on our team or close to us that had the kind of depth in the system center technologies I have. So I realized, you know what, Windows Server, that's a pretty established technology, right? Being an evangelist purely on Windows Server, it is the dominating platform right now. So I really try to say, you know, what's really going to be next? And a couple of years ago, that was looking at the management stack, thinking about, okay, I've got a highly virtualized environment, whether I'm, you know, VMware or Microsoft or Citrix or whoever. How do I centrally manage that to, you know, make operations more efficient? And so as you kind of think of the model of a private cloud, it's about pooling resources, so centrally managing things. It's about constant monitoring and metering. It's about automation. and it's about self-service. And so working with the assistive center technologies, that kind of pushed me towards, well, we kind of saw as the next evolution of the data center, going from being traditional towards highly virtualized towards being a private cloud. Now, we kind of see what's coming next. You know, no surprise, the cloud is next, right? I don't think you can go to a tech conference anymore and not hear that word 100 times, right? You know, you play a drinking game, right? Take a shot anytime someone says cloud, and yeah, you'll have a good time there.
No, I thought it was the year of EDI.
So being cloud, you know, the next big thing, we've all had to kind of be forward thinking of that. So I've started to cover, you know, Windows Azure as well, Microsoft Azure. And then we're starting to see kind of the couple of next big phases. So, you know, what's kind of coming next? Well, next big thing for the infrastructure management guy, IT pro, that's all about the hybrid cloud now. And so being an evangelist, you know, you have to be on the bleeding edge of these technologies. Because when you go to a conference, people are going to be asking you about, hey, I just heard this awesome announcement. Go tell me how that works. And to really have that credibility and competence, you still need to stay on top of what you're working on, continue to be proficient. And I think that's just one of the facets of the technology industry in general, right? It's constantly moving, you know. Like, you go to a college class, and what I learned in college is, you know, almost irrelevant to what I learned today in tech, right? And I haven't been out of college for that long. You compare that to, like, a math major, right? How quickly does the math field move? Not very fast. We're still teaching the same thing we taught 100 years ago in math. So, you know, just technology in itself, it's such a fastly evolving industry that you need to be ready to move with it or you're going to get left behind. And that's one of the challenges, you know, we hear from a lot of customers when we say, hey, you should go adopt the cloud. They'll say, well, I don't want to. The cloud might take away my career, right? But, the reality is the cloud is coming. You know, we don't do stuff in the data center the way we did 10 years ago. I mean, probably no one listening to this is still installing, you know, operating systems using a DVD, right? That was what we used to do 10 years ago. But our industry as a whole is evolving. And so to stay on top of it, myself as an evangelist and certainly people that use our technologies, they kind of got to stay on top of that, shift with the time. So to be successful, you got to go with the flow and be open-minded, be willing to learn new technologies and trial and error, experiment and, you know, move on with it. Yeah.
I'd like to announce that at home I did just buy a Blu-ray player. But
I heard of those things.
But I don't think I have a computer with a DVD player on it anymore.
I don't have a computer with a disk drive anymore. Yeah, Simon, I think you just hit the perfect way to end this session by talking about the ever-evolving skill set in our domain. And that applies just as much to the technology world audience that we talk to every week, as well as marketers every week, because both are at a real cusp of shift in how you measure, how you engage, how you grow in your skill set going forward. And I'm happy to say that we're always happy to have a guest here that is aware of that and constantly improving. What do you say, Whispers? Any last questions or thoughts to close on?
I think it's just really cool that the tribes are mixing. Simon, I mean, you've been at VMUGs and VTUGs. The existence of these kind of cross-tribal, cross-vendor user groups, I think, are really interesting. I actually, at TechEd just recently, I saw a lot of people that I know in my enterprise space, which is not, hasn't typically been super Microsoft oriented, at TechEd this year for the first time. So I'm really kind of excited that I think we're, you know, it's my gut and it's a little bit self-serving because this is what I do for a living now. But I love the fact that the infrastructure people at least are starting to mix again. And I think that's going to be an interesting couple of years. So thanks, Simon. I appreciate your perspective on the Microsoft world, which I think is a little bit mystifying if you're not deep into the Microsoft circle, at least has been. So I'm glad we're blurring the boundaries.
Yeah, it's been a really good demystification as well. So, Amy, anything you're going to be left pondering after this one?
I really am thinking about org charts, as always, and the benefits of having sort of staffed influencers and what that one-to-many role is, and the irony that one-to-many is most valuable and most measurable when it transitions back to one-to-one and one-to-few. So it's a sort of an interesting customer journey and interesting staffing questions as you think about who do you bring on, When do you deal with it programmatically versus individuals, and how do you engage the external influencer audience?
Yeah. I love it. So, Simon, if people want to follow up with you after this and get more of your feedback, what's the best way to find you on the internet?
The best way to find me would be my Twitter handle, at Simon Perryman. Now, I'm going to throw people off here. I have a very unusual spelled name. I'm spelled SymonPerryman. So if you're looking for that other Simon, he's not going to exist. But easiest way to probably find me, if you just search for Simon Microsoft, Symon Microsoft, search for that on Bing or your favorite search engine, and that'll link you straight to me. And I'll be happy to connect with you.
That was
you guys
good.
Like that one?
Such a blatant plug for a product that needs blatant plug. So I loved it. Okay. And we'll link to your profile on Twitter. So great to talk to you today. Very interesting to hear your personal journey from product engineering to evangelism and marketing, and also to hear more of behind the scenes. So thank you for sharing with us. And this has been another week of the Geek Whispers.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as J. Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.
Shit, I totally lost my train of thought. You win. Go.